Call the meeting to order, please. Committee members, we have our first bill that we're actually going to vote on here today, and I'll get to some information about that in just a moment. But first of all, I want to see if Representative Green has read the minutes. I think he was reading them before, and if you would.
Yes, Madam Chair, I did, and I'll move the minutes.
Okay, Representative Green moves that the minutes of February 13th be approved as written. Any discussion? Not. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Okay, Representative Freiberg is here, I believe, and we have House File 83 before us. And members, we have the author has let us know that we are going to put the bill in the order that he wants. Go ahead and sit down, Representative Freiberg. There are several amendments in your packet, but there's only going to be the amendment that deletes the delete all amendment, and then also amendment number 9. The other ones are not going to be offered by the author, as far as I know. Just want to let you know that before we get started, so you don't have to spend a lot of time worrying about all the other things that are in there. But this has been a process that's been interesting. And Representative Hertas, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of order. I was just wondering if the majority had sent this bill out or emailed it out to us in advance for review, and if so, just my commitments last night, I haven't had a chance to really read or review this, so I am wondering if in the future we're going to have a little bit more spread between when we get a bill and be hearing it right away.
Sure. Okay, my committee administrator wants to respond to that. He was the one in charge.
We sent out an email yesterday with the delete all amendment. That is what the author, they wanted in that form. So we sent that out yesterday. That's part of the reason we're actually waiving the 24-hour rule as well, because we knew you didn't have the delete all, with the chance to respond to us. But we did send it out 24 hours in advance.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess I failed to say that we let everybody know that there would be a waiving of the 24-hour rule. And hopefully we won't have to do that very often, but we wanted to make sure, again, that the minority members had a chance to review it just as long as the rest of us did. So that's what we have before us today. So the first thing we'll need to do is to move the delete all amendment, that DE6, to put this in the form that the author would like to. Oh, yes. Who would like to move this bill? I guess I will move the bill. I'll move House File 83 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Civil Law Committee, I believe. Okay. And then I will also move that the DE6 amendment, which is a delete all amendment, be added. And this is the customary motion that we have when the author has put a delete all amendment, which you again have all received. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. We have before you the bill as you have amended with the delete all amendment again, which every member had yesterday. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Freiberg.
I gave an overview of this bill and the reasons I introduced it a few weeks ago at the informational hearing, but I thought it might be helpful just to recap those points quickly. I got involved in this issue because of a constituent of mine, Rose McGee, who lives just a few blocks away from me in Golden Valley. She was a victim of what's known as dual tracking, where a financial institution is ostensibly working with the homeowner to modify a loan, but at the same time is beginning a foreclosure proceeding against the homeowner, unknown to the homeowner. Rose is a longtime resident who's active in the community. She'd lived in her home for 20 years, hadn't had any problem making her payments, but some adverse life changes made it impossible to continue, and she attempted to modify her loan. Unfortunately, while this was going on, the bank began foreclosure proceedings against her. Before learning of her situation, I had no idea that something like dual tracking could exist. I was kind of outraged by that, and I wanted to help. And I want to emphasize this is a problem throughout the state. People tend to think of foreclosure as a core city problem, but it's a problem in the suburbs where I live and also in greater Minnesota. I understand some of the testifiers who are coming here are from greater Minnesota, in fact. The purpose of the bill is to address some of the most common problems I've heard relating to foreclosure. With the chair's indulgence, I'll just give an overview of the bill. Since I did that of the first version, I'll emphasize here the changes that have been made since this committee last discussed the bill. And I want to emphasize, too, that I made these changes after speaking with stakeholders, advocates working to stop foreclosures, but also representatives from banks, small banks, credit unions, housing counselors, and so forth. This bill will have to go through more committees, and I'll continue to work with these stakeholders as the bill moves forward. So just to do the overview here, Section 1 is a new provision in the bill which strengthens existing law. Minnesota law currently requires landlords to notify prospective tenants if the property they're considering moving into is in foreclosure. This way the renter won't be surprised if she has to leave the property. However, in the course of talking to the stakeholders, one thing I learned is that there isn't a strong enforcement mechanism for this provision, and it isn't really being adhered to. So this provision just adds a $500 penalty, and this penalty is consistent with other penalties in the foreclosure chapter of Minnesota law. Section 2 is the single point of contact provision. That was in the first version of the bill, and it prevents homeowners from getting sort of a telephone runaround by requiring them to interact with one person. However, I did modify this provision in response to concerns raised by financial institutions. If the person designated as a single point of contact is sick or on vacation, there is now a process in place to designate an alternate. There's a $500 penalty added to this provision as well. Section 3 is notice that must be provided related to mediation, and sort of the meat of the mediation provision is towards the end of the bill. So if it's okay to the committee, I'll cover Section 3 when I discuss mediation, which is at the end of the bill. Section 4 was in the original bill and requires additional notice be provided to military service members, and I understand one of the testifiers who's going to be here is in fact an Army vet. Section 5 elaborates on the single point of contact provision and also provides a civil cause of action. Section 6 revises the content of the foreclosure notice to provide the single point of contact. Section 7, starting at the bottom of page 5, is the heart of the legislation and prohibits dual tracking. We did expand the provision at lines 6.30 and 6.31 to include not just modification requests, but also forbearance, payment deferral, alternate repayment plans, and deeds in lieu of foreclosure. This now puts a complete stop to the dual tracking process. If the servicer can't start foreclosure until they've responded to the homeowner with a yes or no to the modification request, and they do have the authority to reject a request. Subdivision 5 at line 7.13 adds in a provision allowing injunctive relief. This enforces the dual tracking provision. A borrower can now stop a wrongful foreclosure. Subdivision 6 states that the dual tracking provision applies during the redemption period. Since borrowers may not know that they're being dual tracked, this gives the homeowner relief in the event of a wrongful foreclosure during the redemption period. Section 8 is the mandatory mediation provision, but it has changed since the original bill. The new language is loosely based off of a 2009 mediation bill that passed both houses of the legislature but was vetoed. It creates a mediation program that could prevent wrongful foreclosures. And I should mention, too, that although the word mandatory is used in the title, the borrower has the ability to opt out. I skipped over the provision on pages 2 to 3 that provides notice to the borrower about the mediation. The 2009 bill housed the mediation program in the Attorney General's office. We feel the Office of Administrative Hearings is a natural place for this. They're a neutral agency. My understanding is that House Research has been in contact with the office and is okay with the provision, and I believe a representative is here to answer questions. Housing counselors have played a valuable role in assisting homeowners, so we make sure that counselors stay involved in the process, starting at line 8.1. The good faith and bad faith provisions on page 9 are from the 2009 mediation bill. These provisions place responsibilities on both parties. It says what constitutes good faith, and there's teeth to ensure the parties both act in good faith. Both parties act in good faith. The mediation provision is paid for. The servicer pays a $160 fee, but the borrower pays $40, which is rolled into the loan, so they don't have to pay cash. Presumably, if you're going through foreclosure, you don't have a lot of extra cash, but they are required to pay the $40 fee. Now, since both parties could benefit from mediation, they will both pay. We don't yet have a fiscal note. These numbers are placeholders to an extent, so this may change. I understand from what you said that we're not discussing the amendments with the exception of one that maybe is just drafted that references something in current law. So just for the members' benefit.
That's right. And if you want me to put that amendment on, now we could, or we could wait.
Whatever you prefer, Madam Chair.
Okay. I guess we have a number of testifiers here, and maybe we need to make sure. I think a couple people have to leave, so we better maybe go forward with that, and then we'll have some more discussion.
Sure.
And then we'll have certainly the committee members can debate the bill. Dan Hartman, I believe you're here from Duluth. We have a list of testifiers. And if there's others that need to testify, we need to be notified. Well, welcome to the committee, Mr. Hartman.
Thank you. Just go ahead. Is that okay?
Sure. Welcome to the committee and present your...
Madam Speaker and committee members, my name is Dan Hartman. I'm a counselor at large in the city of Duluth. Last year, I was actually the president of the Duluth City Council. And I'm here to say, first off, happy Duluth and St. Louis County days. As you probably can imagine, you can see a lot of these red stickers around town. And so hope we'll see a lot today.
Thank you.
But I'm here today because I love the city of Duluth and I want to see it continue to get better. And that's why I'm here to talk about the legislation that's in front of you. Over the past 5 years, nearly 150,000 Minnesotans across our state have faced foreclosure. These are folks in your district. These are folks in your city. And people facing foreclosure are your neighbors, your friends, your family members. They're also business owners, workers, and voters, and they deserve our help. This bill provides some protection from unnecessary, preventable foreclosures. I think the common perception is that foreclosures are a Twin Cities problem, and I'm here to tell you today it is definitely not. I'm here because in Duluth, we had over 1,400 foreclosures in the last 5 years. In all of St. Louis County, we've had over 3,000 since 2006. We have lost $544 million in home value in that same time period. Another way to put this in perspective is that one in four homeowners are upside down on their mortgages because of it. So once again, this is a crisis not just in the Twin Cities, but also in our region up in the Northland as well. So I can tell you how depressing it is to walk the city's streets and to see these foreclosure signs, but I think one of the things I wanted to bring to this today was kind of a personal story. In 2009, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to run for office. And on one block, there were three foreclosures. One of those three, I had a long conversation with a woman. Her husband had had a medical issue, and she was now working three different jobs to try to make ends meet. And she had told me, you know what, it's already gone too far. I know I'm already going to lose my house. And this is a woman who, once again, was working three jobs to make ends meet. And so I think kind of the idea out there is there's people who are going to lose their home because they haven't worked hard enough. These are people who are working as hard as they possibly can to make ends meet, and they still can't. And so you got to keep that in mind as these things are coming forward. And just to give you an idea, it costs your local municipal government around $19,000 per foreclosure. That's the legal fees, the expenses associated with it, the policing and fire suppression, the inspections, the maintenance, but also the lost and delayed taxes that we would have had before. To put it another way, the foreclosure crisis throughout St. Louis County adds up to $59 million lost in government revenue. Like you, the city of Duluth is charged with being a good steward of our public resources. And when I think of the challenges and the opportunities facing Duluth, it's hard for me not to consider how that $19,000 could be spent otherwise. Clearly, we don't have enough fire and police. We need a lot more money for our infrastructure, like our sewer, our streets. But also, frankly, we love the city of Duluth, and we want to continue to make it better. And that's hard to do when you have things like this that are taking more and more dollars away from our resources. So to put simply, unnecessary foreclosures hurt everyone. They contribute to neighborhood blight, they depress our property values, they cost local governments, and are a general drag on our local economy. And of course, they're impacting our tax revenues, which is of concern to everyone around here. So that's why I'm here today to say I'm in support of HF 883, which I think is critically important. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members for your time today.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Representative Rudinovich.
I don't have any questions for Councilor Hartman. I just want to point out that before he was a Duluth City Councilor, he was a Crosby Arrington Ranger. He and I went to high school together, so I'm very happy to see him here testifying to this, and I'm very happy to have all of the advocates for Duluth here as well. So I just want to thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dittich.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. I'm glad you're here and bringing all these Duluth people. That's fantastic. I'm from the north, too. I grew up near Bemidji, so, and my niece goes to school up in Duluth, so I'm glad you're here. I appreciate your testimony very much, and we all agree, I believe, that foreclosure is a very difficult thing for the state, for individuals, and for the local municipalities. My question is, there's some very prescriptive things in this bill. Do you have any testimony or expert testimony that you can speak specifically to the prescriptions in this particular bill?
And I apologize at this point. I should have said this at the end of my statement. I have to go to another meeting here. I'm probably going to be already late, so I can't answer a lot of the very specific questions relevant to this. I will say, I think as always happens with any bill, I think right now I'm very happy with the way it's written, but I do think there will probably be changes that may be necessary down the road, but I won't be able to answer a lot of these specific questions at this moment in time. And I apologize to my group who's here. We do have to get up and go. So thank you for that, and I apologize I have to leave so real quickly.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you very much for your testimony. Next we have Sarah Larson. Thank you for coming in from Waverly, Minnesota.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I apologize, I'm losing my voice.
Maybe just get a little closer to the microphone if you could.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Sarah Larson. I'm a small business owner, the secretary of the Montrose Waverly Chamber of Commerce, the treasurer of the Waverly Economic Development Authority, the city of Waverly, a registered nurse, an Army veteran, a wife, and a mother of four. My husband is an iron worker and a veteran. I am from the small town of Waverly. Waverly is the kind of community people dream of raising their families. It is the kind of place where people know each other and take care of one another. A farming community where people are grounded and not afraid of hard work. Waverly has been hit hard with the foreclosures. When I called the mayor to discuss this meeting, she thought there had maybe been as high as 60 foreclosures of the 420 homes in the city of Waverly. The impact on our community has been devastating. My husband and I purchased our home in 2004 before the bubble burst. As veterans, we were allowed to apply for a VA mortgage. We were given a pre-approval letter and put an offering on a home. More than 30 days later, and very shortly before the closing, we were told our VA loan had fallen through, but that they could put us into an interest-only loan, and in less than a year, we would be able to refinance into a VA loan. The economy then started its downturn. Our home lost value. We are currently upside down. We owe $215,000, and our home is worth $125,000. We have been paying for our home for 8 years. Excuse me.
Just take your time.
Thank you. Roughly $150,000 so far. So far, we paid off $2,000 of our principal. My arm was up in 2008, and HSBC continually raises our interest rate. Currently, we are paying over 8%, even while current rates are around 3%. It is increasingly more difficult to pay. We struggle to come up with payments every month. We have fallen behind during crisis points in our life. When my husband was temporarily laid off due to the state shutdown, and with the illness of our oldest child who was receiving chemotherapy. Working with HSBC is difficult, to say the least. We spend hours on the phone and never talk to the same person twice. Sometimes we are talking to people that are outside of this country. We are told different times things every time we call. They claim they haven't received documents, and while they are working with us, they are also starting the foreclosure process and sending us pre-foreclosure letters. People ask us why we stay. Waverly is our home. Allowing my home to go into foreclosure will mean that my neighbors, who rallied when my child was ill and brought food, mowed our lawn, plowed our driveway, and have the benefit to help with medical costs, their home values will decline if I allow my home to go into foreclosure. As a small business owner, I know the economic reality of the foreclosure and what it means to a small town of Waverly. And as a mother who wants a strong community for my family, and as a homeowner, at least for now, I ask you to support this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Questions from community members? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chairwoman. I want to just thank you so much for coming today. You know, I live in Buffalo, which isn't too far from where you are, and I've got friends that live in your community. Good, wonderful people live there, and I really appreciate you coming in and testifying today. And I just have just a simple question for you. Have you had an opportunity to reach out to Wright County Community Action to be their advocate for you as you walk through this process?
I have actually.
Ms. Larson.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
It's fine.
And Representative O'Neill, I have actually reached out to the Wright Community Action Department. They frequently are turning over their housing advocate, and it changes. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how much, but it's frequently been turned over. I've sent emails and haven't received it back. I know that they are completely overloaded with the amount of homeowners that are seeking their help.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Okay, well, thank you so much for making the trip and coming down. I appreciate it. Next, we have Pastor Paul Slack, Recreation Church of Minneapolis. Welcome to the committee, Pastor Slack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I am Paul Slack, Pastor of New Creation Church in Minneapolis, and President of Isaiah, and also a member of Minnesotans for a Fair Economy. Thank you for the privilege to testify here today. As we've heard from the two previous speakers, we really need to do something for the sake of homeowners and for the sake of Minnesotans to stop this unnecessary and unfair foreclosures that are happening every day in every corner of our state. This foreclosure crisis has affected cities, suburbs, exurbs, and greater Minnesota, and they are actually undermining our whole economy. We need to fix this foreclosure crisis with common sense solutions like the Homeowners Bill of Rights. If we adopt the Homeowners Bill of Rights, it will stabilize neighborhoods, create jobs, put money back in people's pockets, reduce the costs of local government. It will lower the number of unnecessary and unfair foreclosures. This bill would indeed require mediation and a single point of contact for homeowners, and will allow homeowners to take their bank to court if it violates the law. In addition, the bill also bans dual tracking, which we've just heard about, and which I believe is a horrible practice. We also understand that African Americans and Latinos have been hit especially hard by the housing crisis. Racial disparities in subprime mortgage lending have been well documented. Minority borrowers were much more likely than white borrowers to receive high-cost subprime loans. The median wealth fell by 66% among Latino households, 53% among African-American households, and 16% among white households. The median wealth of white households is now 20 times that of African-American households, 18 times that of Latino households. These ratios are about twice as high as the ratios that existed before the onset of the housing crisis and recession. But I want to make it clear, it's not just in low-income communities, as you know, that foreclosure crises are real. Recently, a suburban Maple Grove large Catholic church was surveyed, 800 households were surveyed, and out of those 800 households, 60 to 70% were either experiencing foreclosures themselves, their houses were underwater, or they knew people who were experiencing foreclosures. At 75%, the homeownership rate for whites in Minnesota is among the highest in the country, above the national average of 67%. The homeownership rate for blacks at 25% lags the national average of 48%. We clearly need to do something for foreclosures in this foreclosure crisis for everyone in Minnesota. But just when we were beginning to close the gap on wealth in Minnesota, the homeowners crisis hit, and it put people of color back drastically. So we need to act now for the wealth and wealth-building prosperity for all homeowners so that we can all thrive in the state of Minnesota. I thank you for this opportunity, and I am asking this committee, Madam Chair, to act and act now, because we are indeed in the middle of a crisis, and if we act right and courageously in this crisis, I believe we can turn our economy around. More importantly, we can turn the situation around for homeowners who desperately need to stay in their houses.
Thank you so much, Pastor Slack. Questions from community members? Committee members. Representative O'Neill.
I seem to be asking questions. Say thank you, Madam
That's
Chair.
Fine.
Where did you find the statistics that you were quoting? Do you have the references for that?
I can get you
Pastor
the
reference.
Yes, excuse me. My apologies, Madam Chair. If you'd like the references sent to you, I can certainly get you these references as well as many, many more that are documented through our organization, through our coalition of organizations that are working together, Minnesotans for a Fair Economy. We talk to people all over the state, and we can get you the references for these. I don't have them with me right now, but I can certainly get them for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you so much. Let's see, our next witness is Monique White, Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee, Ms. White. If you just introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Monique White. And I'm a homeowner. I bought my house in 2003. That was something that my father helped me do before he passed away. And I was making my payments on time. I received my mortgage through U.S. Bank. And in 2010, I lost my job after being there for 11 and a half years. I worked for a nonprofit organization. And my home had went into foreclosure. And at that time, I had contacted U.S. Bank to try to work with them to see if they could modify my mortgage to make it affordable for me to stay in my home. And at that time, they were advertising a program called the Obama Program to make it affordable for homeowners to stay in their home. And at that time, I had applied for the program. U.S. Bank told me I didn't qualify, and I didn't understand why, because I met the criteria that they were asking for. And it had got to the point where they asked me to write a hardship letter, which I did. They asked for pay stubs. Everything that they had asked of me as far as documentation, I would send to them. And it was really hard working with U.S. Bank just because you never got the same person. I mean, at one point I was talking to somebody from California, and then another time I was talking to somebody in Golden Valley, and so I never spoke with the same person. And my house had ended up being sold, and the way I found out was my heat didn't work, and I called Mini Gas Co. Thank you. And they told me that my house had been sold through the sheriff's, had been through the sheriff's cell. And I ended up speaking with people through U.S. Bank because they were still sending me information and requesting information from me. And I had asked them, how was this possible? Because they were still working with me. So I ended up speaking with somebody from Occupy Homes, and through Occupy Homes and Knock, they supported me and they helped me to go through this foreclosure, which U.S. Bank did end up making me an offer or refinancing my home, but it took a long time. I'm still in my house, but I mean, since the tornado in my community, I live in North Minneapolis, there's a lot of people that have lost their homes. And my thing is, if they're going to keep taking from people, you know, you're taking from the community. There's a lot of abandoned houses in my neighborhood, especially with the tornado that has happened. So, I mean, if you guys can pass this bill, this will help a lot of people to be able to stay in their homes. And not only that, separate families and keep them together if they can stay in their homes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Representative Isaacson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I just want to say thank you for having the courage and the strength to come up here and share that. I know that's got to be a tough story to talk about in a group, especially people you don't know. And I really appreciate you showing strength for yourself, and really helps the community as well. So that's wonderful. My question is, you said that you had asked them, you know, they said you asked, you applied to qualify for that program, and they said you didn't qualify, but your understanding was that you did. And when you asked them, did they say why you didn't qualify? Did they highlight that, give you some sort of documentation or anything that would tell you, you know what, you didn't qualify because of this?
Ms. White?
They told me that I didn't have enough, I didn't make enough income. And my thing is, I know when they did first come out with that Obama program, one of their criteria were if you didn't, if you lost a significant amount of your income, which I did, mm-hmm. because my job, for they went under.
Sure.
And it wasn't that I didn't have income. They didn't even give me a guideline of how much income you were supposed to qualify for in order to qualify for this program.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
So once you had learned you have not qualified and you asked them about that, they said that you didn't make enough income, but then was there an explanation? What I'm hearing you say is there wasn't an explanation of what that meant, how much you should have made, and did they understand also the current situation you're in with the job going under and your income reduced? Did they have any knowledge of that at all, or...?
This way.
That's when they, like I said, they had asked me for a hardship letter,
mm-hmm.
and in my hardship letter, I did explain all of that, you know, that
great.
I lost my job.
And so while that was going on, oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you. I'm still getting used to that.
Right.
Madam Chair. Thank you.
While
that was going on, indeed, we're seeing a real classic example of where they continue to talk to you about the amendment process. And being dragged out for your mortgage while they indeed actually sold your house out, is what you're telling me. So those two things were happening at the exact same time.
Ms. White.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for your testimony as well.
I just have one question, too. Did the people that were working with you from the bank give you any idea about folks that you could contact for help, for counseling, for, you know, did they give you any information about your opportunities to have the foreclosure postponed, anything like that?
No, ma'am.
All right, thank you. Well, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, just thank you for being willing to share your story with us today. I had a question about when the house was sold. You said you've been able to stay in it, correct?
Yes, sir.
And when you were working with the bank during that process, were there extra fees after the sheriff's sale and closing costs and things like that were associated with staying in your home?
Ms. White?
After I ended up going to court and the judge ordered me to pay rent until things were resolved.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mensa?
And so you paid rent to a home that you previously owned, and that money went directly to the bank in the meantime?
Ms. Wade?
To my knowledge, all I know is I paid rent and I made the check payable to U.S. Bank.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I share Representative Isaacson's statements to you. Thank you for your courage to be able to talk about a difficult time for you. My question centers around a little bit of your testimony regarding your attempt to renegotiate. You mentioned, I believe, some interest rates, and I'm sorry, that was the other testifier, but you mentioned that you had a mortgage, and ultimately you ended up working with an organization you referred to as Occupy Homes, Occupy Minnesota.
Ms. Rice?
Yes.
White?
Okay, and thank you. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on that opportunity to stay in your home, what that provided to you in terms of mortgage amount or interest rate, or how was that essentially the same type of contract that you were trying to renegotiate with the bank, or was it materially beneficial restructured differently that allowed you to stay in your home based on your changing economic circumstances. If you could just comment, give me a little bit of an overview as to what you were trying to renegotiate and what you ultimately ended up being to use as a toolbox to stay in your home.
Ms. White.
Occupy Minnesota is an organization that came in and supported me, and I had people living in my home and living in my yard, I mean literally supporting me, and they supported me as far as like going back and forth to court with me. In the process, I had started going into a new career, and I ended up going to a shareholders meeting that U.S. Bank was having, and I, when they opened up the floor for people to speak, I spoke directly to Richard Davis, and he ended up putting me in contact with one of his colleagues, and I don't remember his name right now, but through a numerous of months, they finally came up with an agreement to, and in the beginning, that's what I was asking for, was a modification to make it affordable for me to stay in my home. So they did end up, after several months, renegotiating my mortgage and making it affordable for me to stay.
Representative Hertos?
Thank you. So to be clear then, it was the same institution that you originally were working with that ultimately provided the opportunity for you to keep your home and to stay in it. After the sheriff's sale and redemption period, normally the course of action there is to, you know, obtain entirely new financing. And so the fact that it was the same lender that ultimately provided you with that is interesting to me, that you didn't have to go somewhere else to obtain that financing.
It did take a while because U.S. Bank had actually sold my house to Freddie Mac, and it took a while. And I mean, I went to Richard Davis's house. I went everywhere just to make sure that this was heard. And if it wasn't for legislators like Bobby Joe Champion, Keith Ellison, the Attorney General's office, I don't think they would have worked with me to assist me if I didn't have all these people helping me and supporting me.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just pondering your testimony, and I came across something else that made me go home, so I just want to, maybe we can expand on it for a second. Can you tell me again how you discovered that your home had been sold?
Ms. White?
I'm sorry. My heater, mm-hmm. furnace wasn't working,
mm-hmm.
and it was back in October or September, and I had called the gas company to see if Service Plus could come out and check my furnace.
Sure.
And whenever they ask you for your account number,
mm-hmm.
and one of the person that I was speaking with over the phone said that I needed to call the bank or my mortgage company because I no longer my gas bill wasn't in my name anymore, basically.
And that's
Representative Isaacson.
And that is when you essentially discovered that the home had been sold.
Yes.
So
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. At the same time, going back to a previous point, but I think I want to drill down just a little bit here to really understand. At the same point that this was occurring, you were also in communication with the foreclosure or the amendment people that were helping you amend the mortgage, right? And going back and forth with letters and discussions, and you said, you know, maybe you hadn't spoke to the same people that many times, but was that occurring at the same time?
Yes, it was.
Ms. White.
And did they at any point indicate to you that your house was up for sale, was being sold, or had been sold at that point?
No, sir.
So,
President Isaacson.
So that I understand this correctly, because it just frankly boggles my mind, they sold your house while trying to sell you an amendment to your mortgage at the same time.
Ms. White.
To my knowledge, yes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I just feel bad you had to go through that. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? I also just want to comment. It seems to me like, well, I guess, did you end up having the person that was referred to you by the president of the bank, that person continue to be the single person that you could work with for a while? Did they give you a person to work with continually, or what did that amount to?
At the end, I was just working with one person.
Okay. And you got that opportunity by going to the president of the bank?
Yes,
in a
ma'am.
Shareholders meeting. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one quick question, and maybe I missed it when you began your testimony. When did this happen? When did it start, and when did it end? How long ago was it?
My house went into foreclosure in 2010. That was around the time I lost my job. And just this June that just passed in 2012 was when I was able to come to get a new modification.
Is it O'Neill?
Thank you, Chairwoman. And like, I'm just trying to figure out, like, was it a two-year, took 2 years to resolve? Is that about what it was? You didn't really say when in 2010, but mid-2010, like a two-year process? Or
it's close to a two-year process.
What?
I want to say
2 months. Seems like it's about 18 months, if I'm adding that right. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. About 18 months.
Okay. But it resolved, and then you're still in the house now.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I do have one. Oh, Representative Mensah.
Just to follow up to Representative O'Neill's question would be, I guess, more clarity. How long did you work with U.S. Bank? I know the whole process was 18 months, but how long did it take them to sell your house in that process? Do you remember?
In that process, I want to say maybe a month or two. Before I actually started working with them, or before I actually found out.
Thank you. Mr. Mitzel?
That's all. Thank you.
Okay. I guess I do have one other question. So you ended up paying rent for how many months, would you say?
Three or four months, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. And was that rent credited to your mortgage account? Do you know?
I don't know. All I know is every first of the month I would take a check down to the government center, and that's where they collect, I guess they hold it in escrow or whatever down there.
Sure. Okay, well, thank you very much. I think you answered a lot of questions. Thank you so much. We have a couple more witnesses. Tess Rice from the Minnesota Bankers Association is next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm Tess Rice. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The MBA represents about 400 banks in Minnesota, or about 94% of the banks in the state. We have not had much chance to look at the newest version of the bill, and there are substantial changes to it, so I can't be real specific. We are still waiting to get some feedback from our members on the new language. But I did want to let you know that since this bill's last hearing, the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, came out with rules addressing almost everything in this bill. It's 1,117 pages. It's a comprehensive servicing rules package that every financial institution will have to follow. The first section of the bill is, or the one about service members, I wanted to make sure that you were aware that two notices go out currently to service members. That's required by federal law. Every single homeowner, when they are 45 days late, receives a notice informing them of a phone number for homeownership counseling. And then there's a separate notice to everyone letting them know that if they are a service member, it details their rights. It's a full page long, and it also gives toll-free numbers to military helplines that help them through the process. The single point of contact section in the bill is also addressed by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's rules. They did determine after much review that it would be appropriate to do either a single point of contact or a department as a contact. They said that there's very substantial procedures, pages and pages long about this, just this part, but they require that the bank or the servicer have every person be able to access every bit of information that might be needed to deal with the borrower. So they thought that it might be inconvenient if an employee was not available, if there was just one named to the borrower. So they require procedures to make sure there's always someone available that can talk to them about their options and their existing loan, where they're at with their loan. And there are also auditing procedures required for this to make sure that they are being followed. So internal audit procedures exist in the rules. And in addition to that, the CFPB will be examining for compliance with these procedures for every institution over $10 billion in assets. Smaller institutions will be examined by their primary federal regulator for compliance with these rules. Dual tracking is prohibited in the federal rules as well. What those rules do is they prohibit a servicer from starting foreclosure within the first 120 days after a payment is late. If a borrower submits a completed application for some kind of loss mitigation option, and that involves many things, including a modification, foreclosure sale can't occur. So as long as they get in 37 days before that scheduled sale, the servicer can't conduct the sale until it determines whether or not that borrower qualifies. There is an appeals process as well. So if someone is determined not to qualify for a loss mitigation option, the servicer is required to assign a totally new set of eyes to that process to see if there is possibly some option that they could qualify for. As I mentioned, the rules are very lengthy. Live contact with the borrower is required within 36 days after that first payment is late, at least an attempt at live contact. Notice goes out within 45 days informing them of all the loan mitigation options for which they may qualify. So the rules are extremely lengthy and detailed and comprehensive. And that's about all I have for comments, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Rinovich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rice, I heard a lot of discussion of the CFPB rules. When do those rules go into effect?
January 2014.
Okay, so about a year. Representative, Madam Chair.
Representative Rinovich.
Representative Freiberg, when would this legislation go into effect?
August 1st of this year.
Freiberg.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Rinovich.
So assuming that there's a great deal of overlap between the rules and the Homeowners Bill of Rights here that we're looking at, Ms. Rice, could you tell me, are you in a position to elaborate to what some of the objections might be to accelerating the implementation of some of these rules?
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Representative, the 1,100 pages of these rules that a servicer will have to implement, and when I say servicer, I mean from the very largest to the very smallest banks, will have to implement these procedures. They're accompanied by thousands and thousands of other new mortgage regulations that have been issued just since January. And so the time it takes to figure out how they're going to comply, hire the people to do this, the CFPB determined that it could not be done faster.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Rice, I guess listening to your testimony, you said people get two letters if they're a veteran within 45 days and a number for a counseling agency. Does your organization or the organizations that you represent contribute to this counseling agency, or is it state-funded or federally funded?
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's through the through HUD, that's a federal agency. So I think federal funds are used. And I think they coordinate throughout statewide. So they will, once you call that toll-free number, they'll set you up with someone in your county.
Madam Chair.
Representative Metza.
I'm confused, and again, my question at our previous testimony that you gave is, until we start talking about regulating your industry, you'll continue to have practices like this. And in my mind, you're sending a letter, and instead of offering counseling at your bank and inviting these people in, or the banks that you represent, you're sending them off to another government agency that's going to have to get back in touch with you. So you're separating that amount of time and, you know, adding to the clock for someone, in my perception, where you could simply have sent them a letter saying, hey, come on in and meet with us, and let's start working on this.
Ms. Rice?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm telling you what the federal laws require, and I did not mention there's also a state notice that goes out prior to foreclosure, letting you know of the pre-foreclosure counseling that's available. Banks are free to do just what you said, and I'm sure that many do.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, as you described the new rules and implementation, could you comment briefly on what is now in statute in Minnesota prior to the new regulations in terms of notification to homeowners? Obviously, people do not get foreclosed on if they're making their payments, so there's usually some circumstance which, you know, brings them to having to deal with an untenable situation. And systemically, it's, you know, foreclosure is a problem, but the real problem is, you know, a healthy and vibrant economy and jobs and security. So with regard to the process and some of the testimony that we've been listening to, the last testifier in her closing remarks said her home went into foreclosure on a certain date, and when it was resolved, but during the testimony seemed to acknowledge not understanding or knowing that the home was going into foreclosure. So oftentimes maybe people get things in the mail and don't understand its importance or what that means. But could you comment, please, on what is, you know, currently in statute in terms of notification requirements?
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the pre-foreclosure notice will go out first. I mean, there will be late notices that you're late on your mortgage. The pre-foreclosure notice goes out. That's required by state law. I believe it has to be in a different color than white to kind of capture people's attention. It gives them information about their rights and about counseling options. And then there would be the notice of sale or the dependency notice. So a law firm will file that, and the homeowner would be served with that notice of sale, informing them of the date of their foreclosure sale.
Representative Hertas.
So the homeowner has to actually be served, and service has to be executed, or are there other provisions in the mortgage documents that prevent them from having to be served?
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Representative, state law could not be obviated, if that's the right word. You couldn't go around state law. You have to serve that notice of foreclosure, or you would not have a legitimate foreclosure.
Okay, Representative Hertas.
So what you're saying then is that in the mortgage documents you don't waive a right of presentment or anything like that?
So, Madam Chair, Representative, no, that would be illegal to ask someone to waive that right, and then that foreclosure sale could be annulled, I suppose, if the bank or the lender couldn't prove that they had served the appropriate notice. That would be a void sheriff's sale.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hertas.
So the one inconsistency that I've heard here in all of the hearings that we've had in this discussion is people claiming that they've never received any notice that their home was being foreclosed and that the home had been sold. And what you're testifying to is that state statute prohibits that.
Ms. Rice?
Madam Chair, Representative, the occupant of the home, I believe, has to be served. So if they are the homeowner and living in their home, they would get service.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rice, regretfully don't know as much about the foreclosure process in general as some of the people in here. You know, maybe that is, of course, a fortunate thing as well. Could you talk to me about So let's say that someone borrows money, that they end up with their mortgage underwater. So their home value, you know, I mean, so they bought when the value was high, value is no longer high, they're upside down on their mortgage. They can no longer make their payments. We start to go through this process. And then they paid, you know, some amount on their principal over the course of making their loan payments. As they lose their home and as this goes forward, I've heard a lot of discussion about the expense of the foreclosure process to the banks, to the municipalities involved, and, of course, to the homeowner themselves. Once the bank decides to foreclose on a home, I assume that they keep the principal. Is that correct? That's been paid to that point?
Ms. Rice?
Madam Chair, Representative, any payments that they've received prior?
Any payment to the principal is now the property of the bank, right?
Yes.
Rice.
Madam Chair, and then so the home then is in the possession of the bank as well after that point to sell again.
That's right.
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends on who purchases the home at the sheriff's sale. If the bank does purchase the home at the sheriff's sale, then they would be the owner.
Okay.
There's a six-month redemption period after the sale where the homeowner can stay in the home.
Okay. And so at some point, I assume that the bank gets less back than they've put out in loans, that they, you know, by the time they've recovered what they can, that there's a difference there. Is that correct, right?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Right. Okay.
The House would probably have left.
So we're on the same page so far, Madam Chair. Ms. Rice. Is there, you know, in the tax code, is there any way that the bank can write off some of that bad debt or some of those losses?
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm not a tax law
person. Okay. Okay, I'm curious to, you know, as to, you know, what remedy is available for the bank. Madam Chair, Ms. Rice, could you speak to, you know, I do hear that this bill, through the process of mediation, will, you know, as the success rate of mediation is high and it allows the two parties to come together and to restructure this loan, that there is a benefit inherent to both the bank and the homeowner. Could you speak to directly, you know, why the organizations that you represent don't either believe that to be the case or, you know, are in opposition to this bill?
That's right. Madam Chair, Representative, we just got a chance to see the mediation language day before yesterday, I think. I haven't heard back from the members yet on the mediation process. Mm-hmm. We have worked on mediation in the past, and there was a consensus bill that was mentioned back in 2009. So we have tried to be someone that would be at the table trying to craft the best language possible.
Okay.
I'm going to let the author, who wants to say something quickly here, and then we'll get back to other committee members.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair. I was just going to say I do know about the CFPB rules, and I've taken a look at them. As Representative Radinovich mentioned, they don't go into effect until 2014, so I think there's a need for them. They also don't contain an explicit right to stop a wrongful foreclosure, so they don't put a complete stop to dual tracking. And in my mind, the enforcement mechanism is also somewhat unclear, and it's much stronger in the legislation here. You know, Ms. Rice mentioned the single point of contact language references, you know, an individual or a department. My fear there is just that, you know, in a large financial institution, the department could be a large number of people, so it's still not clear to the homeowner who the single point of contact is. And finally, my understanding is that the rules themselves are under legal challenge as well. There's been a challenge against the authority of the director of the CFPB to issue those rules. And in the event that litigation proves to be successful, I think it's important that we have something in place in Minnesota.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Mariani, I think you were next.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Freiberg, actually, I think, helped answer a number of questions that I had in regards to the CFPB. A couple things, though, I want to ask very quickly. Perhaps Representative Fiber can answer the first question. Are the CFPB rules meant to bind all lenders? Is it comprehensive in terms of who's covered, or is it subject to, you know, whoever whoever the parties were to the lawsuit that apparently is being referenced here in terms of national lawsuits. I just want to know the scope of CFPB. Is it supposed to cover all lenders?
I think it's... Yeah, the CFPB rules aren't in reaction to a lawsuit. Okay. There is a lawsuit challenging the authority of the
I
CFPB.
See. Okay.
But there's a separate lawsuit against some financial institutions.
Okay.
But those are two distinct things. I'm sorry if I conflated them there.
Maybe Ms. Rice knows the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, if the question was whether those rules apply to all lenders, they do. There are some exemptions for small servicers, so that's going to be a servicer that services less than 1,000 loans a year and also only services their own loans, so loans that they've originated or one of their affiliates originated. So if they don't sell those on the secondary market, then they would qualify as a small servicer. A small servicer still has to wait 120 days before beginning the foreclosure process, and they cannot continue with the foreclosure if a loss mitigation application has been received.
So, Madam Chair, thank you, Ms. Rice. That's helpful. So there are some carve-out exemptions here under CFPB, and at you know, first hearing, that those makes sense to me. Ms. Rice, given that the rules are apparently under some kind of legal challenge, does your association formally accept the CFPB's authority to issue these rules?
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Representative, we certainly have not contested the CFPB's authority. The industry consensus is that there is almost zero chance of these rules being repealed. If there's a very small chance that Mr. Cordray could be removed from that agency because his appointment may have been illegal. What he did was still under the authority of the Treasury, the Secretary of the Treasury, and that makes those rules still legal. And if someone, and the off chance that someone said that those weren't legal either, the Secretary of the Treasury could just recertify them. So the industry is definitely operating under the assumption that these are the rules going forward and they need to comply.
Madam Chair, Ms. Rice, thank you. I appreciate your forthrightness with it, and I concur with that view on the part of the industry in general about the legal rightness of the eventual rules here. But still, Representative Freiberg, what you've got is a situation where the rules, in fact, are continuing to be challenged. And I think that, and I've struggled with this because obviously, you know, we're going to have some overlap here, assuming that your bill is enacted and CFPB rules is currently, proposed or go forward in implementation. But, you know, as a state legislator, which ultimately, you know, is my responsibility, I want to make sure that we're covering appropriate policy areas with state law. And it's not unusual, Madam Chair, that we would have state law that often overlaps with the federal government, but that certainly doesn't bar, state elected officials to act on behalf.
That's right.
Now, I totally get that, and I'm listening carefully, Ms. Rice, I totally get that, you know, there may be some implementation issues that may arise by, duplicative, perhaps inconsistent, language here and there. I'm not insensitive to that. However, I don't think, Madam Chair, particularly given the fact these rules are under apparently pretty serious challenge, that we shouldn't move forward. I would certainly hope that Representative Freiberg would continue to work with the banking sector and the lending sector to be able to work out whatever, unintended, harmful, duplicitous, whatever, issues that may arise. So anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have another witness and an amendment, and I'm just, because of time, there's a couple people that have not had a chance to ask a question. One of them is Representative Moran, who indicated you wanted to ask a question. So why don't we go ahead and have you, and then we're going to have our last witness, and then...
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll get back to others of you as we can.
Yeah. So, I have heard a lot of testimonies around individuals who have gone through foreclosures and different rules that are in place by banks to notify homeowners that they're going through a foreclosure process. So I guess one of my questions to you is, how common is door tracking in the banking industry?
Ms. Reyes. Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
So based on the Madam Chair,
sure,
based on the latest ruling, did I hear you state that going forward that lenders will have to abide by the current status of that court case?
Ms. Reyes. Madam Chair, Representative, there's a couple things at play. There's a national settlement that I think 48 states, AGs, have, attorney generals have participated in, and I have heard that it impacts anywhere from 65% to 80% of the market here in Minnesota. Those dual tracking is already prohibited for 80% of those loans. When the CFPB rules go into effect in January, there will be a federal prohibition on dual tracking for everyone.
Madam Chair. So just to be clear, 80% right now, dual tracking is prohibited for 80% of those institutions.
Representative Moran.
Correct.
Madam Chair. Representative, the AG settlement is the five largest banks, and I'm unclear whether it's between 65 and 80% of the market is already, that they cover that market, those five banks. They're servicing that percentage of the market. And as part of that agreement, dual tracking is prohibited.
Okay. Follow up? Any last question?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rice. We wanted to hear from David Skilbrand from the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. This will be our last witness. Representative Isaacson, can you wait till we get this testimony, or is it about the...
Yeah, I'd like to say something.
Okay, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the previous testimony. And there's been a distinction made that I think it's important to understand here. We've talked about what is legal and illegal and what the statutes say, and then we have the reality of what is occurring. And I want to make that distinction very clear, that while we have the laws that are saying something's not supposed to happen, the reality is, if the testimony is to be trusted, which I feel pretty comfortable with on the most part, that still occurs. And so my concern is that even though we see now a mandate coming down from the federal government on that, I'm not sure, to me at least personally, how that testimony has any bearing on whether we pass this bill. Right? That's my concern. Yeah. And so I just want to be really clear about that.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Skilbrand.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Introduce yourself, please.
David Skilbrand. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, about 300 chartered banks throughout the state with about 550 branches. I want to, first of all, make sure you are aware of what type of business those banks run. And those banks are committed to a community. Over 100 of them are 100 years old. They know the people that they serve. They know their parents, their grandparents, their children. They are a personal-oriented banking practice. They are not a transaction practice-oriented model. And that's very important when it comes to loans that are made, because you have a higher degree of desire to make sure that they are successful loans. Because when you see that person next week on the street or next year on the street, if that loan is bad, that's not a good situation. And secondly, if the loan does go bad, unfortunately, even though you've made your due diligence, you will want to make every effort to try to fix the problem. And this is very important when it comes into the issues of single point of contact and dual tracking. I understand that with the large financial institutions, you get a 1-800 number, and every time somebody picks it up, it might be somebody different. In our case, you walk down to the bank, you go to the person who gave you the loan, and that person is probably going to be the one that works with you. So you know that person, and you have known them for a long time. Likewise with the single point of contact, that's the person. As Ms. Rice testified, these provisions of single point of contact, prohibiting dual tracking, and also service member notices are already in either the CFPB rules or in the Service Members Civil Relief Act. So those are in play, and they have been in play, and they are working themselves out. With respect to the mandatory mediation piece, I just want to say that, again, small banks and their lenders have a relationship-based model. Lenders will reach out to those customers who miss a payment, and they will do so as soon as possible. Generally, after that first payment is missed. Depending on the situation, they typically continue to work with the customer for 3 to 6 months more, trying to see if there's an outcome that can be made that it is beneficial for both borrower and lender. And only after that will they finally turn it over to a foreclosure process. So it's after all of the details have been looked at and they've thrown up their arms and said, you know what, it isn't going to work. That's when they finally turn it over to a foreclosure process. In conclusion, I just say that the three proposals in the bill have been acted on, and so this is duplicative. If the state language differs from the federal rule or federal law, that sometimes can cause a problem for us on the implementation side and also on the examination side. And that is a concern for us. Secondly, with respect to the mandatory mediation, mediation sounds very nice, and the Minnesota nice, but in order for it to work, you have to have two willing parties, and you have to have two willing parties who both have something to give up. If only one party has something to give up, then that's not mediation. I want to thank Representative Freiberg for talking to me a little bit about this bill, and I'll continue to talk to him as we go down the road. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'm always concerned about unintended consequences, and this bill in general just concerns me greatly, as we have 1,100 pages of federal regulation coming, and this is a how many page bill? 10-page bill. Can you, the AG settlement, that's also, so we have 1,100 pages of federal regulation coming, and the AG settlement just happened, which prohibits dual tracking, and somewhere around 80%, I'm guessing, of the five major banks, and so your banks are not included in that, but it sounds like, if someone had a problem with a loan, they walk right in and talk to the person that gave them the loan in the small banks. Can you tell me when the AG settlement went into effect? So was that just this last January?
I think the settlement was agreed to, if I remember, in October.
In October.
And that was in testimony last time, but I forget exactly when it went into effect.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So from your perspective, hopefully you've had a chance to look at, we've just sort of gotten now another amendment without being able to look at it prior, but if you've looked at the language, the delete all amendment, can you tell me what are some of your greatest concern is an unintended consequences that will arise of this when we start to bring in the federal rule plus what just happened with the AG settlement? What is your greatest concern of the unintended consequences of this? You talked about being duplicative, and what other concerns do you have?
Mr. Skilburn?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, One of the things that I'm still not clear with the bill, because I just saw it yesterday also, but one of the things that I do see, and if I'm correct, it would concern me, and that is how the process is kind of front-loaded. So now everybody needs to, the borrower needs to take part in counseling, and then after that, the lender is mandated to take place and part in mediation. And during all or most of that time, I believe, the foreclosure process is stayed. And then some other things might come up during the process having to do with the dual regulation. And if they come up, then there might be another stay. So one of the consequences that I see of this is right now the common practice for my lenders is to spend 3 to 6 months working with the borrower, trying to get a deal that works for both of them. If there's a whole bunch of things that we have to do to jump over as a result of a new legislation that would extend the process and extend the length of this ordeal, which is already somewhere between 14 and 18 months, that would concern a lot of people, I think, and it might cause them to pull the trigger earlier because they know now they have to go through all this other stuff. And that might not be as good a solution as the one we have right now.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up question. So would it, is it possible then that these smaller banks would maybe stop lending and just stop making these types of loans because it's too prohibitive and too difficult, especially with the $500 fees and things like that that come?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Skilbred, I think that's an important question
Chair,
to answer.
Representative O'Neill. There is concern among my members, not only because of this proposal, but because of the numerous proposals that are coming at us from the federal side. There's a big debate right now on what is a qualified mortgage, and which is what we used to call the old-fashioned conventional, 20% down, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Then there's also a debate on what's called the QRM. That's a mortgage that you would sell on the secondary market. Mm-hmm. Then those two definitions relate backwards to another definition of what is rural. And there is an exemption for rural lenders and rural lenders who serve underserved areas. But that definition we think is too narrow, and we have a lot of lenders that would not be able to make loans because they don't qualify under the rural definition. And when you add in all of the new requirements and the cost that that takes, I had a lender tell me the other day that they're really looking at whether or not they're going to continue to write mortgages. And I would say that that would be a very bad outcome and an ironic outcome, because the causes of the event that we are responding to were not caused by community banks. But if the solutions push them further out of the market, then the market is going to be further turned over to those who did cause the event, or people in some area will be underserved. And neither of those is probably a very good outcome.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. So if this moves through the process and it's implemented August 1st, where the federal rules will roll in 5 months after, and the federal, the CFPB has already determined that that's the amount of time they need to implement their 1,100 pages of new regulations, and many of these things are duplicative with the federal regulations. How problematic is that going to be for the industry, for your industry, to implement this 5 months earlier than the federal regulations are rolling in? How problematic will that be?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, that's a good question. The CFPB allowed more time because they thought that lenders needed more time to figure out what the details were in order that they could implement them correctly. And at some point in time, I mean, there are some lenders who might need to change staff, beef up staff. Staff that does conforming regulatory issues in banks right now are growing, and they don't make a cent for the business. All they do is comply, and there's a growing pressure on banks to have that personnel larger, and for the smaller banks, that becomes more and more problematic. If you have a 15 employees in a bank, the one who does compliance might do several other things. It's getting to the point where that can't be done. So now there's a lot of action going on, and now some banks are working with other banks and sharing a compliance officer, training efforts to beef up the compliance officer's ability. But there's, it would be, you know, they would obviously try to do their best to conform because that's what they have to do. But it wouldn't help the situation.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. Gilbert. We have a couple of other people that do want to testify. Are you? Okay. I believe we have Mr. Lipman from the Office of Administrative Hearings. I'm sorry, I didn't know that you were. You're welcome to the committee. Go ahead and have a seat. I realize that you wanted to testify. We're glad to put you in.
Madam Chair, my name is Eric Lipman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. I just want to make some brief comments about our agency and how we might play a role as to Section 8 of the bill with respect to mandatory mediation. From our perspective, the Office of Administrative Hearings is a leader in offering high-quality dispute resolution services wherever they're needed across the state of Minnesota. We serve Mankato and Menomon and Montemedi and Worthington, every place in the community where there's a state program or a contested case. Our judges are providing high-quality dispute resolution services. What we regard ourselves as being particularly good at or as assembling teams, solving difficult legal problems, reducing costs, being a mediation leader. In our workers' compensation division, there are 6,000 cases filed each year, and each of those are subject to an early settlement conference. And so, again, we have teams of highly trained professionals who do mediation and innovate in getting to yes. A little bit of background about our agency so you can understand how this fits in. We have three divisions. I spoke about the Workers' Compensation Division. I'm the Assistant Chief of the Administrative Law Division. We have 7 full-time ALJs and 4 contract ALJs. The Administrative Law Division works on an enterprise fund. We bill state agencies and local units of governments for whom we do work on an hourly basis and receive those billing backs, and they're annually appropriated. Working on a revolving fund. Our rates are approved by MMB, so we don't necessarily decide what rates we're charging. There's an independent review by Minnesota Management and Budget, and our costs are detailed, and there's a detailed audit trail reviewed by the legislative auditor. So again, what this results in is below market rates for legal services, because MMB is a hard negotiating partner, a uniform application of those rates, and they're supported by a vigorous audit trail because the talented teams of the legislative auditor are making sure that we're not gold plating or gold bricking anything, and that all of the rates that we're putting in are supported by the actual expenses and needed and necessary expenses that are there. So we think we're a good partner Our judges and staff would be a good partner, and our contract affiliates, many of whom are 114 neutrals. We're trained in these areas. We're good at interagency agreements. We're a leader in interactive television and our hub city arrangements in order to provide legal services wherever they might be needed across the state of Minnesota. Our one particular concern, although we're excited about this opportunity to be a partner in solving these most important disputes, one question we would raise with Representative Freiberg as this matter goes through the process, and likewise the committee members, and we realize this is an evolving discussion, is to think clearly about the $160 and what kind of mediation services that one can provide. Again, OAH is a below-market provider. We're not looking for to charge what is ordinarily for these services in the marketplace if you were to go out there. But again, we're interested in delivering experienced professionals who are knowledgeable about these complicated financial transactions and actually having them have some time with the people in this dispute in order to resolve their differences. And I guess I would urge Representative Freiberg, as the process continues, to think how much $160 can actually apply. An earlier version of DE1 said that we might be able to have some sort of arrangement to charge the lender our in fact actual costs, and we were assuming that MMB would be looking over our shoulder. That seemed a better arrangement to us. We're glad to do whatever the legislature sees fit, but mindful that file review, staff intake, actual mediation time, and whatever output filings you're going to want, whether it's some sort of template order, all has to fit into $160. And so we want to provide lots of value add, and so our one comment on this legislation, as excited as we are about the promise and what we can do to deliver genuine value, is to think about the realism of that figure as the process continues. And with that, I'm delighted to stand for any questions the committee may well have.
Committee, we're running out of time. I'm hoping that folks can and with us for a little bit. If not, we'll have to reconvene later, but I'm hoping that everybody can stay with us for at least a few more minutes. Representative Freiberg, do you want to comment at all on Mr. Lipman's testimony, or should we go on?
I sort of mentioned it at the outset. The $160 isn't meant to be totally final, and I look forward to working with Judge and former State Representative Lipman as the process moves forward, as he says.
All right.
Madam Chair?
Else?
Just very quickly, thank you. I just want to acknowledge Mr. Lipman's presence here. It's good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
Here again, I had the privilege to serve with you a number of years ago. You're a fine public servant, and it's good to see you're continuing doing good work for the public.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The honor is more mine than yours, but I'm grateful.
Representative Isaacson, have you a brief comment?
Just a quick question. When you said that the $160 will, it'll purchase so much mediation, is there any sense at all about where that would actually lie in the course of that process, or is that still so unknown we couldn't even predict where we'd fall in that dollar value?
Madam Chair, Representative Iverson, we're trying to make some good guesses. We think that in large measure this is a function of volume. So one of the things we'd ask the author and others to think about is what kind of economies of scale they could help us to achieve. Again, we're not interested in making inflated salaries or banking any profits. What we don't want to be in is in a situation where in rescuing upside-down situations, we find ourselves in an upside-down situation. So as long as we can, I think, fairly account for costs, and so that will be a collaborative of people trying to make good guesses and to follow costs, and we're eager to be a transparent and energetic and creative partner in that enterprise.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. All members, it looks like everybody's still in their seats, so I'm going to thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Lipman.
Thank you kindly, Madam Chair.
Department of Commerce is here if there's any pressing questions. I want to let you know that, too. There is one amendment that I would like to offer. It should be non-controversial. This is the A9 amendment. It's existing law. There's no new language in here. It's exactly existing law that's been around for decades. It just makes sure that this affidavit of postponement, which allows a person who's already had a sheriff's date set to receive this information, or requires them to be received this information about their opportunity to get the what's called affidavit of postponement. And I just learned about this, and I'm sure that a lot of our homeowners don't know about it either. I did ask earlier one of our witnesses if they'd ever received this information, and the answer was no. So hopefully this is non-controversial. Any questions about the amendment? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Looking at the amendment, I don't see anything where it says to delete anything else. So are we going to have two Section 6s starting on page 4? It doesn't say to delete anything to the previous Section 6. So how is that going to work?
Oh, Mr. Representative Anderson, if we've got a little technical difficulty here, I'm sure our staff can take care of that.
Thank you,
Ms.
Madam
Mullen?
Chair. Yes, the reviser will renumber the sections.
Okay. Okay. Any discussion? Otherwise, I will move that the A9 amendment be added to this bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Sorry. Motion prevails, and that amendment is adopted. The bill is before us. Representative Freiberg, any final comments? We are going to take a vote here before we leave.
Sure. No, I appreciate all the time you've given to this really important issue. I do think this is an important issue, and I think the state has a role in resolving it, so I thank you very much for your time. I look forward to working with all the interested parties as this process moves forward.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question, Mr. Freiberg, or Representative Freiberg, excuse me. On the language or text of the bill on page 7, excuse me, under subdivision 6, the redemption period, and it references that the relief available in this section is available to a borrower during the redemption period under sections 580 and the failure of the servicer to comply with the subdivision. And when I went back to that section 580, it would appear that...
Madam Chair?
Representative Isaacson?
Can I ask a question, Representative Hertogs? Just could you? I'm just trying to catch up to where you are. Can you repeat that? Where you're talking about? Just so I hear that. I just missed it. That's all.
The line and page.
Certainly,
Representative Hertogs.
Representative Isaacson, on page 7, subdivision 6, which is line 7.17, it notes redemption period, and it refers to relief available under section 580.03, and when I referred back to that. In subdivision 3, it seems to be, and maybe the maker of this bill can clarify it for me, it seems to infer that the redemption period is the period which is post-sheriff sale. So the property is already been sold. And the definition of that means that you are, you know, no longer the fee owner, it's been sold, but you have this statutory redemption period. And in the section of 580, it refers to being able to call for mediation, and it seems like that's a little late. It's a little after the fact. I'm sorry I lost the language that I was looking for here, but it seemed to be incongruent with what what can happen after sheriff sale.
Representative Freiberg?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, this language is in here just to make sure the dual tracking provision is as strong as possible. You know, we heard from people today who didn't know that they were being dual tracked, and they didn't find out that their home had been foreclosed until their utilities had been turned off. So, you know, since borrowers may not know they're being dual tracked, this provision that you reference in subdivision 6 gives the homeowner relief in the event of a wrongful foreclosure that occurs during the redemption period.
Representative Hertas.
Madam Chair, so the reference in this subdivision 6 is a wrongful foreclosure.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes, it would be wrongful if the dual tracking occurred. It's, and then the relief, you know, it talks about the relief that's available. That's relief in the event of something in violation.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. That was a good
one more comment. I just wanted to comment on Representative Radinovich's question when he was asking. You made the reference to the foreclosure process and principal payments having been made by the borrower, and you had asked if the bank kept your principal payments. And I just want to remind you there's a difference between principal payments and equity. The bank, in that circumstance, made a loan, advanced all of the funds for the purchase of that home, and all of the payments that were made, principal payments, were payments for reduction of the amount owed. Yes, that money belongs to the bank. So I didn't want to have the suggestion that that was the homeowner's equity, those payments of principal that are lost in the foreclosure process, that those were repayments on that. Unfortunately, equity is usually the amount or value of a home between the sale price and what is owed. And in the foreclosure market, you're not in control of the sale anymore because you've lost the home, so there is no equity. Or if there is equity in a good market, most people in the past have been able to resolve their dilemma by selling their home during the foreclosure process and saving the equity that's there. But in the market that we've just been through, oftentimes the value of the home is upside down, so the equity has been lost even before going into foreclosure just because of market conditions. In my experience in this industry in the last 35 years, I have never known before this last recession a housing downturn that has lasted more than 12 to 18 months. We have been blessed in Minnesota by never really being drawn into the fray of national economics. It's always been a strong economy. It's been a diverse economy. And I've assisted several people liquidate or sell their home and save their equity before the redemption period is over after sheriff sale, which, you know, put money in their pocket and they were able to move on despite whatever circumstances brought them to foreclosure in the first place. So I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you
very much. Okay, members, no further discussion. The bill is before us. I'll renew my motion. Oh, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one thing I did want to know, brought up on a question here, is will this apply to the Minnesota Housing and Finance Agency and other nonprofit lenders?
Representative Freiberg.
I believe it applies to all of them. I know there was a fiscal note, I think, on the for the MHFA too, showing no cost. Do I have that correct?
Mr. Soderberg.
Madam Chair, members, in your packet you'll find a preliminary fiscal note that is from Minnesota Housing Finance, and that discusses the impact on their agency. This will apply to their agency as well as private lenders and other nonprofits, and they are saying in the fiscal note that they could absorb the cost. They figure it'll be about $600 in the first year and then ratchet down as the years go out. And at $160, as the bill was presented at $160, it'd be about $96,000 ratcheting down in the out years. But they say that they can absorb it.
Okay.
Representative Green.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. The only other thing I would just like to bring up is that you guys all know that I'm from a very rural area, and we depend greatly on our banks, not just for mortgages, but for other things. And I have a feeling, I mean, looking at what's going on out there, that the housing market is going to change. And because we have the rules coming from the federal level anyway, I'd be really cautious of this, simply because if we put undue strain on the small banks or even any lending agencies, we may stifle their ability to make loans or their willingness to make loans when the housing market opens up, and that could, you know, slow things down again for us. So thank you.
Okay, I think got a couple more quick comments. Thank you, Representative Isaacson. No?
Just one quick comment, Madam Chair. Representative Green, we gave these banks lots of money a few years ago on the federal level to make sure that they were out borrowing people money, and seems to me like it didn't work too well as far as it getting back to these people going and lending and remodifying mortgages. All I've heard from people up in my district is all the complications that they're having dealing with the industry there, and I guess I'll just leave that as a comment. But you know, I think we're coming from the same angle here. We don't need duplicative restrictions and things like that that are going to interfere with this, but they just haven't been doing it anyway. So
okay, Representative Green, you have the last word, and then we're going to vote.
Okay, Madam Chair. Well, I won't. I'll keep it calm then. But a lot of the smaller banks didn't get the money for that, and they're still loaning the money that has been deposited in their bank from local people. I mean, this isn't a pot of money that some big banker owns in most of our cases in the rural area. This is, you know, our parents' savings that's being out there, and they are more careful with it. And so, you know, it's a big thing for us.
Okay. Thank. Unless it's Representative Hertz, is it really? If you really need to speak, I will give it to you, and then we will vote. But is it important?
Thank you. I want to reiterate what Representative Green said. The small banks didn't receive the type of bailouts that you're referring to. We want, in the housing industry, and Representative Isaacson and I had a comment before committee this afternoon, there's real value in home ownership. And it's a nonpartisan issue to want to have people own homes. But when we need to be very careful, because if you're going to start imposing additional regulations which may actually cause banks to speed up the foreclosure process and be less yielding because you're drawing out or extending the time, you're inviting small lenders, which, as Representative Green said, are people, state banks and locally chartered banks, which funds are derived mostly from the local community. You have your local farmer sitting on the board of directors. They're members of the community. It's not the Wall Street Bank. They're the Main Street Bank. They're the ones that really make the difference in Minnesota. And what we see is when you take away capital from the housing market, when you decrease access to capital, you decrease demand. And you cause something that is an unintended effect. And so I would caution all members to be very careful about what we're about to do. We have federal regulations pending that are going to address kind of a blanket thing. And as a policy decision, you know, we just need to be careful about that. And, you know, that's a really important point to make. And you know, with regard to the housing industry, it has suffered, and this is a phenomenon, and I hope that as we arise from this, that we don't ever have to revisit these issues. But hopefully, when you have a normal market, which is 1.5% foreclosure rate statewide or on average, that's a rate that is sustainable, that doesn't threaten the base, doesn't threaten the market, and allows people and those houses to be quickly absorbed into the market from the demand that should normally be there. But in the lack of job security and the lack of access to credit, this is something that is a problem, and I hope will go away soon. All of us in the housing industry wanted to see it go away. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you, and I want to commend the author and actually give you the final word, and I will renew my motion as soon as you do give us the final word, and just say that I know that you have been very, very careful and very cautious and open to talking with all the different folks, and I am really hoping that we will, this will make a difference. We heard compelling testimony for the need. Final word at all, Ms. Representative Freiberg?
Thank you.
All right. So the chair will renew the motion to recommend House File 83 as amended be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Thank you. Did I have somebody? Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I still think there's an issue with this last amendment that you offered, the A9 amendment, and we're working on it. It may be technical in nature, but again, it's such a late hour in the afternoon. If you're going to make this change again on the fly, that's your prerogative, but there has to be another change made to that amendment.
Can you clarify what you're referring to?
I think the way that Representative Anderson is reading it is that because the amendment is inserted on page 4 after line 31 and it's section 6, there is also the subsequent section also makes changes to the exact same section. So instead of incorporated the two changes, there's two sections, one right after the other, changing the same section. And we've asked the reviser to renumber the sections in sequence and correct the internal reference, but those two would probably be harmonized by the reviser.
So let's just be clear that we are very interested in making sure the reviser has the correct instructions, and that will be incorporated as part of the amendment. I will I guess I have incorporated that into the amendment. We talked about it earlier, and I want to make sure. Thank you for your careful look at that. I appreciate it. Okay. House File 83. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed and will be going to civil law.
Thank you.
Thank you. And committee members, thank you for waiting. I really do appreciate it. The meeting is adjourned.